I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it.
Welcome back to part two of the interview with Rabbi Adlerstein. Here we get into a lot of different topics. The divinity of the Torah, different movements, Dennis Prager, and lots more. We start off with the issue of Orthodox rabbis participating with Reform rabbis in a public setting.
The issue of participation with non-Orthodox rabbis in a joint panel or a joint event is one that that I agonize over, and it tears me apart, because on the one hand, failure to participate is interpreted completely wrongly, but interpreted by people, and I can't blame them, as not just standoffishness or principled decision to not participate for some reason, which we'll get to, but a sign of rejection, not just of their beliefs, but rejection of them as Jews. And as an Orthodox Jew, I don't have the option of deciding whether I want to accept every other Jew. That's as much a part of the Torah as Shabbat or Kashrut or anything else. I can't decide that loving my fellow Jew is no longer a mitzvah in vogue. It's something I would have to do even if I didn't feel it. If I didn't feel it, I'd have to develop the feeling, and I'd have to teach it to my kids and to my community. And I do feel it. And when I'm forced to draw back, knowing how other people are going to see that and how hurtful it's going to be, it hurts me. But I've been burnt. I've been burnt by participating, even though when I did, it was done very, very carefully and with permission and asking the right authorities, and still I've been burnt. I don't know what the right answer is. I do know that for many decades there has been a policy in parts of the Orthodox community, including the parts that are dearest to my heart and where my training comes from, of drawing a line in the sand, of seeing that a certain degree of participation confers conscious or subconscious legitimacy upon others. And that's something that I can't do. I recognize that there's a price that I'm paying, and it hurts me to pay that price. But as I've gotten older, I've also seen that there is a definite gain in it. Sometimes, for many people, the position seems so bizarre that people are curious about it and ask, why is it so? Aren't you just really on a continuum of practice with others? And then when you actually have an opportunity of explaining why it is that we're not on a continuum with Reform and Conservative Judaism, that we're off the chart, and that it's a completely different belief. We are part of one people. We share one mega soul, one mega neshama. But in terms of ideology, we're in a different place altogether. That itself is something that causes people to stop and to listen and to want to explore. And it does yield some fruit to the community. There are people who are serious seekers, and when they see this attitude, which seems to be so counterproductive, wind up understanding what it's all about and are attracted by it. So, like most everything else you've asked me before, I can give you arguments on both sides, but I don't participate in such panels. At the same time, one of the reasons why I can't is because I'm a rabbi. My presence may confer a certain amount of legitimacy. I don't tell the same thing to my students or to lay people who are in my orbit. And I believe firmly that the more contact that we have with our fellow Jews in all orbits of Jewish life, the better off we are going to be, and that there still is a common language that really can bring us somewhat together, especially if you leave rabbis out of it, and that is Torah study. Especially in the last decade or so, there's been an explosion of interest in all denominations in Jewish texts. Different denominations have radically different approaches to those texts, but the other denominations don't always write off the contributions of traditional thinkers and are open to it. And sometimes they're even open-minded enough to understand that if you really want to understand a 19th century rabbinic text, go to somebody who's really immersed himself in it. And sometimes they'll invite us in and there'll be opportunities, not so publicly, but privately, outside of the limelight, where there is no conferring of this legitimacy, where it can be done, and then you find Jewish hearts melting in the presence of each other.
I now ask about his relationship with Dennis Prager and how he would react to this conversation.
We would both be uncomfortable because we've been friends for literally for decades. Dennis, you know that 29-year-old I told you about before? Dennis was the guest speaker at his bar mitzvah. So we go back some. And we've had the arguments face to face. We've studied Torah together. We're still friends. Dennis pointed out many years ago the irony of the fact that Orthodox Jews often appreciate him, even though in observance he is further from them than some other movements that are closer in observance and yet entirely shunned by Orthodox Jews. And what he discovered quite rightly was that there is a platform of shared values that are very important to Orthodox Jews and that are important to Dennis as well. And that I believe many Orthodox Jews understand that when those values are presented well, and he does a great job presenting many of them well, that it's very inviting to people from the outside, people who've never given Judaism the time of day before. There are scores of people in my neighborhood who are now practicing Orthodox, Shulchan Aruch abiding Jews who got their first step sitting in a car on a freeway someplace and flipping through the channels and hearing Dennis and hearing Judaism presented in the way that they had never heard before. That was their start. Now, they've long since surpassed Dennis in their observance. Dennis jokes about it himself. Dennis argues, were he to become an Orthodox Jew, all of those people would never be attracted. So he's far more valuable to the good Lord than this way than as an Orthodox Jew. He'll settle that one day after 120 years with God, and if God decides to excuse him, I won't have any objections. However, according to the rules that I was taught, that's not a decision that we make for ourselves. I do believe, in the absence of any voice coming from heaven, that because Dennis has a Jewish soul, like all the rest of us, that there are realia of Jewish life, which are that you can't decide not to feed yourself the things that you need to survive. People who decide that eating is silly, and there's no real reason to spend so much of my day pursuing caloric intake, will quickly find themselves dead. If you don't give the body what it absolutely needs, you can't survive. The soul is not very different from that. Matter of fact, I don't know why you hedged. It is no different than that. The Jewish soul requires contact with 613 commandments, or at least today, in today's times, with the 200 plus that are applicable in modern times. The soul can dry up in whole or in part when it's not fed properly. And I love Dennis. He's a remarkable person, and God will certainly reward him for all the positive things that he's doing. But I personally believe that he would be all the much greater if he would be able to find his way to halachic observance.
I point out that I've heard Dennis Prager say that it's the oral law that he has the ability to pick and choose from.
Right. Right. And that is precisely where I disagree with him. I think that to Dennis, if there's no rational appeal in where you draw the line, where you set the bar, then it's just not part of the religion. And I think that's a terrible, catastrophic mistake to make. That part of what God asks of us is to relate to God in a serious manner. And let's face it, God is sometimes very, very close and very understandable. And sometimes God seems very, very remote. We are human beings. We can't fathom and embrace all of God equally. In order to relate to God, we have to be able to accept the reality that there are parts of God we can understand and parts that we don't. There is much good that comes. I thought I turned that off. Mm-hmm. Nope, I might as well take it. Sveiki. How you doing, Sveiki? What's the matter? Oh, okay, so get some sleep tonight. You just interrupted a documentary taping. Yeah. You want to say hello to all those people out there in TV land? Okay, I thought I turned the cell phone off. My mistake. What's doing? I don't know why. She was picking up before. No. Oh. Okay, Tweaks, try to get some sleep tonight. Okay, bye, Tweaks. That's one of the kids we never got around to.
I leave these little moments in to show the behind the scenes of an interview. It's not always as clear cut with soundbite after soundbite. But I thought maybe if Rabbi Adlerstein is listening to this, he might get a kick out of it, remembering that call from Tzviki. But now back to the issues at hand. What is the oral law and why is it important and all that?
One of the most treasured concepts in Jewish life is something called Kabbalat Ol. It means accepting the yoke of heaven. Now, there are a lot of nouns that the rabbis could have used for practice, some with far more positive connotations than yoke. But part of serving God means serving God, not what you find in the space between your two ears. People who only accept upon themselves the parts that they find rational and immediately appreciated aren't really serving God. They're serving their cerebral cortex. God is a mystery. And I think God deliberately asks us to do things that we can't always understand in order to drive home that point. Not to mention some of the other positive consequences of submitting to a halachic lifestyle where you have to ask questions about everything that you do, including these little trivial picayune issues. It's an amazingly resourceful tool for dealing with life when you have to have the discipline that all things in life, A, are questioned, are not equipotential. They're better ways of doing even the smallest things that you can consider. They're ways of bringing you closer to God or moving you further apart. Every moment of life is an opportunity to draw closer or further away. The lesson that one learns that life is about small things, not about large things, that real growth comes from countless little baby steps, not the giant steps. The idea that very, very small differences in human behavior can have enormous consequences for the world out there. All of these things are subliminally reinforced by being part of a lifestyle with a lot of structure and a lot of rigor. It gives you the discipline. It gives you the connection to God. It makes you feel the importance of small human actions. These are very important things that are missed entirely outside of the Orthodox community.
So is there a difference between oral law and written law in terms of practice? And you can violate some of the oral laws, but not the written laws.
But why not? Why not sleep with a man and then reinterpret the text as they're considering at, as we speak at UJ, of saying, well, the ban on male homosexuality just means homosexual rape. Not consensual, not a loving relationship between two people who agree on the nature of the bond that that connects them. Anything is open to interpretation. I like introducing the oral law to my students at Loyola by talking of a guy who is seen plunging a knife into this defenseless woman 20 times on network TV with people yelling and screaming and unable to restrain him. And 100 million people witness the brutal slaying, and he comes up for charges. There's a trial. He sits silently and impassively through the whole trial, and they're a march of witnesses, not that you really needed them, and there's like, well, nothing to say in the guy's defense. And of course the jury returns a guilty vote, and comes time to sentence him, the judge says, well, we're going to sentence you to die in the state gas chamber. And he says, like, whatever for? And the judge says, well, you know, where have you been? We convicted you of murder. He says, murder? The judge says, wait a second. Did you not kill that woman? Were you not the one? You never denied it? Did you not wield the knife and do her in with your incessant blows? He says, of course I did. He says, well, so what's your problem? That's why we're sentencing you now to die for that crime. He says, murder? That wasn't murder. That was my mother-in-law. How do you interpret a phrase in the Bible of lo tirtzach? You shouldn't murder. Is every act of killing murder? Clearly not. Judaism believes in self-defense, believes in war. So where do you draw the line? Perhaps mercy killing is not murder. Perhaps killing your mother-in-law is not murder. Maybe Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment wasn't really murder. She was on her way out. He's an aspiring young author. Maybe that's not murder either. Everything's up for grabs. Indeed, if you don't see this book as a book of law, if you see it as I think it was Solomon Frihoff who once said, for the reform thinker, I think it was him who said that for the Orthodox, there are 10 commandments. For everybody else, it's 10 suggestions. They're ultimately no givens. The most absurd part of the position is that which is taken commonly in the conservative movement, that there are parts of the Torah that are divine and there are parts that are man-made. Which parts are divine? The parts that make sense to us, the parts that appeal to us. The parts that clearly don't are the parts that are wrong. And the parts that are wrong are the parts that came from man. It was Jonathan Sacks, now Chief Rabbi of England, who pointed out, wait a second, so you're really saying that man can only get things wrong, and anything that's right came from God because man can't get it right. What a dim view of the human spirit. Now, we don't believe that. Man can get plenty right, but God always gets it right. And we do believe that the core foundational element of our peoplehood and our belief was the fact that there was revelation at Sinai. We are alone among religions in that. We don't get our start because of a belief in the prime mover or the first cause, or because how else did the world get here, or because of this God of the gaps theory or that God of the gaps theory. There must be a God, because otherwise what's life about? There must be a God, because who else put it all together? There must be a God, because look at all of the intricacies of creation. Those are all fine arguments if they help you along, but that's not why Jews believe. Jews believe because we were at Sinai. We believe not only did God speak to us, but that God spoke to us in a language that man can understand. God will remain a mystery, but he's smart enough to come up with a language that can communicate his will to man. We can't even conceive of a God who won't communicate that will to man. What kind of God is that? Because of that, we're not going to second-guess God. When God writes in his Torah that there's certain things that cannot change, like anything that's actually in the written text and its explication in the oral law, we're going to stick with that. We relate to God like children to parents. If a parent has to take a child to a doctor for the first time, and The doctor is going to jab the kid with a needle and give him some kind of injection. And the kid, why is my father, my mother doing this to me? The kid held in the arms of a parent will understand. It hurts, but I understand that it must be for my good because my parents wouldn't be doing this for me if it doesn't. We have that relationship with God. God's our Father. He doesn't get anything out of this. He's a perfect being. There's nothing we can do to make life easier for him. It's not like he needs our commandments because otherwise, you know, Rodney Dangerfield, and I don't get no respect. Anything that God asks us to do is for our good. If we insist on having to understand everything, we're not accepting God. We're creating a man-made religion. That's not for me. If this religion is man-made, I'm putting my tefillin on eBay and I'm out of here. So where do you draw the line? I think the conservative movement largely has been a failure. And it was a valiant attempt to conserve. It was a reaction not against orthodoxy in its beginning. It grew out of a reaction to the distance that reform had gone, the famous Treif banquet in the 19th century. But the idea was that orthodoxy will never make it to America. That goes without saying. And let's try to conserve as much of the past as we can. But the conservative movement never really succeeded in creating a consistent conservative laity. I think Marshall Sklar in his classic treatise on conservative Judaism, and he's not Orthodox, but he's a great American sociologist, you know, bought into the standard take out there. There are no conservative Jews, only conservative rabbis. Now, I know that that's not true. There are many conservative Jews out there, but not a fraction of the number that the conservative movement predicted there would be who would take conservative law really seriously. There definitely are some, and I respect them. I bad for them because I think they only have half the truth, but I accept them as my brothers, and I do respect their tenacity, but I do think they're wrong.
And now we switch gears to talk about the origin of the Torah, whether the Bible is divine, and some of the proofs that are given by biblical critics to show that the Bible is not God-given, but man-made. One example I give is that Moses speaks in the third person, and if he was truly writing it, he would write in the first person.
Yeah, I think I vaguely have heard this idea before among many, many other arguments that I've heard for the non-divinity of the Torah. And I've studied much of the thought of non-Orthodox Judaism. Sometimes things make me think a little. Sometimes the answers are pretty apparent. I have to grapple with questions like everybody else. The issue of Moses's writing in the third person is not one that disturbs me at all. One of the great classic commentators of hundreds and hundreds of years ago addressed it. And the argument always is satisfying to me that there's a very important point there that whatever is in the Torah, including the speech of people, Moses and everybody else, ultimately all of this got vetted by God Himself, who was the one who dictated the final script. This is God's version of what people said, because His rephrasing of it is what becomes Torah, what becomes eternal, what is shaped in such a way that people can find lasting, redeemable social value in it in every generation. So that's not an issue that bothers me so much. And if anything, the fact that the issue was raised literally 600 years ago is just another example of the idea that all the issues that are raised, to the best of my knowledge, are simply a question of perspective. If you come in to examining the data from one vantage point, you'll come up with one set of answers. If you come from a different perspective, there are answers that you can give and approaches that you can take. And they are equally attractive, if not more attractive at times. But it all depends on what it is that you want to find. If you approach biblical text as the work of human beings, then I think I myself would argue that it would be the product not of a single author, but of multiple authors. And I'd have been in the same quandary. Is it four authors, three authors, 42 authors? You know, all these things go back and forth. But if you accept the premise, which I do, that it's the consequence of a single author, then there are ways in which you find meaning in the various differences and the various styles and the difference between the style of parts of Vayikra and the reason why one name of God is used here and not another one is used there, and that there are attendant stylistic differences that accompany them. There are multiple ways of answering those questions that are consistent with the perspective that you start with. So it's all a question of what you want to find in the end. It's, you know, like the old story of the four blind men and the elephant. You know, depending on where you're prodding and what it is that you want to find, that's what you're going to come up with.
Thanks once again to Rabbi Adlerstein for another incredible interview. And we have two more parts coming up. I want to remind you to visit our sponsor, Hazaka.com. That's HAZAKAH.com. Jewish games that feed the brain. Thanks for listening.
All right, that's it. Hot as hell, Jay.